welcome to Adler University on Social Health and Change podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley, and today we're talking sex. In our first segment, we're going to address what good sex education looks like and really why it's so important. And then later on, we'll discuss non-monogamous relationships and what to do if your child comes out as gay. With us currently is Kalki Nakai, a doctoral candidate in Adler's Doctor of Psychology and Clinical Psychology program. Kalki has certification in sex education for young adults, and she wrote her dissertation on porn literacy. Kalki, thank you so much for your time and being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It is fascinating not only when I read the bio just now, but when I read your bio initially, I was really, really intrigued by what you were going to bring to the listeners. And also, since I brought the listeners up, I want to remind them to make sure to subscribe to our podcast so that these will auto-populate in your devices. And you can do that via, of course, iTunes, wherever you download your Android podcasts, or right there via the WGNplus.com page. So, Kalki, again, thank you for being here. To jump right into this, I know so many people, especially parents, teachers, etc., really mainly parents, sex ed is an uncomfortable topic. If you can explain to us, kind of broad stroke, why is it so important?
That's a great question, Hannah. And I think it's easy to say that without comprehensive sex education, we're facing substantial public health and financial issues. So it's without being said that sex is sort of really interesting for youth, and they end up having sex around the age of 17. There are some theories that explain why youth are engaging in earlier sex. Could be from peer pressure to lack of structural activities or adult supervision, or maybe some other structural factors like economic inequality or social marginalization or even media influences. But the statistics are out there that show that youth from 15 to 24 actually have the highest STI rates and unintended pregnancies. So we're looking at, without education or access to condoms or contraception, youth are just more likely to become early parents. And there's a figure out there that shows about 60% of teen moms don't graduate from high school. They're more likely than their peers to live in poverty, to depend on public assistance, and be in poor health. But their children also suffer. They have maybe more health and cognitive disadvantage. They're on child welfare or involved with the correctional system. They themselves end up living in poverty, will drop out of high school, and become teen parents themselves. So alarmingly, every year, the United States spends about $9 billion on child-rearing costs. This doesn't include the cost of treating STIs, which is about $6 billion, and that doesn't account for spending on HIV and AIDS treatment. So really, sexual risk-taking is the pertinent concern in the context of sexual and reproductive health, social justice, and overall well-being among youth. So while there has been evidence that teen pregnancies and STI rates have gone down in the last 25 years because of comprehensive sex education, we're still the only industrialized nation to have the highest rates of teen pregnancies and STIs. So really, comprehensive sex ed is important because it's designed to improve public health access and information, but it's there to help youth make safe, consensual, and informed decisions about their own bodies, about sexuality, and relationships.
All right. I want to clarify two things. STIs are sexually transmitted infections?
That's correct.
Okay, excellent. As I upspeak on that, so I apologize to everyone listening that I went a bit Kardashian on you. And then you said that those rates, while they have dropped, are still very high. Is this because kids are still having sex, even though they're not knowing anything about how to make those decisions necessarily properly? They don't have all the facts in front of them to prevent and protect themselves.
Yeah, they don't have all the facts, but they also don't have access to contraception or contraceptives. They don't know where to go to get this information, but to get the services that could be STI testing, HIV testing, where to go get pap smears, or, you know, just taking care of their health in general. So it's useful to teach education and also the skills that helps to delay sexual initiation, but it's to prepare them with this information and the skills so that they can protect themselves and their partners when they do become sexually active.
Okay, so ignoring it is not making it go away. They're still going to do this. They're just not informed. And to cut right to the crux of this, having that ignorance out there is costing us a lot of money. So when we talk about comprehensive sex education, how are abstinent-only programs fitting in here?
Well, simply put, Hannah, you know, youth are thirsty for sex ed. I mean, abstinent-only programs, they just don't provide or include information about contraception or disease prevention methods. So even though the government had funding had spent, I think, over $1.5 million for abstinent-only programs under the Bush administration, there is substantial evidence that demonstrates that the states that only rely on abstinent-only programs are seeing higher rates of teen pregnancies and STIs. So this isn't really coincidental, like we were talking about. When you're removing education and access to services, youth are still engaging in sex because this is a normative developmental process. But now they don't have access to the right information or to the services to help them engage in safe, consensual, and protected sex. But what's interesting is that abstinent-only programs were actually found more practical for younger-aged youth. So if professionals are teaching sex ed and abstinence at an earlier age, youth could actually benefit from developing healthier sexual attitudes and having a more secure identity against sexual pressure. So right now, I think about 19 states require that sex ed only include what's called abstinence-only until marriage education. And these programs only emphasize abstinence from all sexual behaviors outside of marriage. So they typically emphasize failure rates of contraception and disease prevention methods, and they only present marriage as the option for morally correct sex, basically. But in President Obama's budget for fiscal year 2017, he's eradicating abstinence only until marriage funding. But there are still resources available for communities of faith to teach sexuality and healthy relationships all throughout the lifespan, from pre-kindergarten to older adults.
Okay, so I think it's been pretty clear that your opinion is that that is not a really good plan. Abstinence only doesn't necessarily work. While it could be still very accepted in many, many communities, it, based on your research and the stats behind it, it's not the way to go. So tell me what a good sex ed program looks like.
This is a really good question. Good sex education looks like medically accurate, age-appropriate, and evidence-based information. In 2014, President Obama provided $185 million to fund comprehensive sex education. So as of January 2015, 22 states, including the District of Columbia, are requiring public schools to teach sex ed, and 20 of those states mandate the requirement, where 19 are asking that the information is medically accurate. So there's six different domains that really highlight what good sex education looks like, and that includes human development, which is looking at reproduction and sexual anatomy, puberty, body image, sexual orientation, gender identity. It's also looking at relationships between family, friends, but also the nuances of love, of dating, what marriage looks like, what raising children looks like. Also looking at personal skills like values and decision-making, so looking at risk versus responsibility, communication skills with regard to negotiation, boundary setting, refusal skills, how to seek out help and use resources. Also looking at sexual behavior, so not just abstinence, but also masturbation, fantasy, and dysfunction. And then, of course, sexual health, looking at reproductive health, contraception, STI, HIV, AIDS, pregnancy, abortion, but also what consent looks like as far as you know, what is happening in the relationship considered sexual abuse, assault, or violence? And then finally, kind of looking at society and culture. So discussing power and privilege and gender roles, looking at law, religion, diversity, the arts, and the media, particularly with internet pornography. So the goal of good sex education, aside from learning accurate information, is giving youth the opportunity to question, to explore, to assess their attitudes and values in contrast to what they've learned from their family, from culture, from society. It's asking children or youth to improve their critical thinking skills. It'll help them increase their self-esteem, their self-efficacy, to develop interpersonal skills where they can have respectful, supportive, and pleasurable relationships. But all in all, the major goal is really to promote personal and social responsibility.
But the question for many, many parents, and I'm one of them, is when should we teach this? And when, as parents, should we start talking about this?
This is, I think, the golden question. And this can often become really controversial, depending on your values and what you feel is appropriate, but also what your comfort level is in discussing sex with your spouse or with your friends. So there's a lot of different factors involved in the sources and timing of sex education. But the research really shows that the healthy sexual development of children really comes from the home. So if there's a collaboration between home and school education, this is where we can start to address the risk-taking, but also promote responsibility. We want to prepare them throughout their lifespan on how to navigate a sexualized world or their sexual relationships. So, you know, there's age-appropriate education, for instance, during, you know, kindergarten through third grade. You know, perhaps parents can have a dialogue about giving information on understanding body parts with proper anatomical names, as well as understanding appropriate and inappropriate touch, like you're looking at boundaries and you're trying to help the child not put shame around the body part or around the topic. You're normalizing this conversation and you're inviting them to have more conversations with you as a safe agent throughout their lives. Then as they grow, maybe into fourth and fifth grade, they can actually discuss the changes that occur during puberty, maybe learning respect for diverse family structures and gender expression. As they venture into middle school, then they can learn about healthy body image, analyzing media influences, dealing with peer pressure, and emphasizing the choice of abstinence with the education on contraceptives. And then finally, in high school, this is where youth can actually learn how to access accurate information, where to go to receive services in the community for contraception or STI HIV testing, talking about healthy relationships and boundary setting, and also what the effects of alcohol and other drugs are on decision making, and even information on the financial responsibility it takes for raising their own children. So that's sort of like a small example of what age-appropriate education can look like throughout development.
So I like that you addressed the fact that obviously people have to address their own comfort level, because that's going to be some people just don't, they're not comfortable talking about it themselves, let alone addressing it with their children. So really good information on looking online and finding resources that are already available. And I have to jump in. I love the video with the tea, how it explains consent. I'm guessing you've seen that. I just think that's genius. genius. So if anybody needs to understand what consent is, look for, just Google tea and consent, and it explains everything. Kalki, thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate you being here. And when we come back, we're going to talk with a psychologist about how to best support your child when he or she comes out as gay. Again, this is Hannah Stanley, your host for On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And don't forget to hit subscribe. We'll be right back. We're back for part two of the sex episode. I'm Hannah Stanley, the host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I want to remind everyone to hit subscribe wherever they download their podcasts from, or of course at WGNplus.com. With me now is Josh Wolf, a professor of psychology at Adler. His research interests focus on the intersection of religion, spirituality, sexual orientation, and gender identity. He's here to talk about how to respond when your child comes out as gay. Now, Josh, first and foremost, thank you for your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Beside my interest in your interests and how those all intersect, obviously you're the right person to talk about with this, because this is another topic that's going to make parents, of course, but people in general, it could make them uncomfortable. So for those, we're going to focus on the parents, of course, for those who even are very supportive and have always figured themselves to be supportive, they might not know the best way to respond when their child comes to them and says, guess what? And that's a very vulnerable time for that person. What advice do you have for those parents?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to your point, I talk to parents and all the time who really, really want to be supportive. They really are accepting of their child as a sexual or gender minority. And when I say sexual or gender minority, I mean just sort of this umbrella term of kids who could be gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer, questioning their sexual orientation, or transgender, gender nonconforming. And I'm sort of just trying to include everyone.
Blanket everyone.
It is. Exactly, yeah. Yes. I don't want to leave anyone out. To your question, lots of parents who feel supportive of their child's sexual orientation or gender identity still are unsure of how to respond. And I can understand why parents might feel this way, since talking about sexual orientation or gender identity issues may be something that they've really never done before, or this might be the first time they're having this kind of conversation with anyone, let alone with their own child. So it may feel like a lot of pressure to say the right thing or know the right thing. So, just to underscore the importance to parents of having this conversation with their child, their support is really critical. Actually, research tells us that family acceptance of sexual and gender minority youth greatly reduces the risk of depression, substance abuse, risk for contracting sexually transmitted infections like HIV, rates of homelessness, poor school performance, as well as suicide attempts. So again, just having a supportive parent or parents can actually protect against all of those things. And for many sexual minority youth, family acceptance is even more important statistically than other external forms of validation, like the support they can get from their friends at school, or legislation to protect sexual and gender minority children. Not that those things aren't important, but again, that family support is just this really crucial piece.
All right. So gay marriage was obviously a big win
for
that community.
Of course.
But family acceptance is still far more important to them individually.
Sure. And I think an issue like gay marriage or same-sex marriage is critical that adolescent or child knows them. It changes their perception of the future, knowing that a legally recognized relationship with someone of the same gender is now an option to them. But at 16, that may not benefit you for another 10 to 20 years. And there, that's not an immediate reward or immediate benefit to an adolescent. So again, that family interactions, those are every day. That's really a critical piece.
But knowing that you can come down to the breakfast table and speak honestly about who you're dating.
Exactly.
Allows you to have, as you mentioned, less depression and less substance abuse and all of the things that people do to cope.
Exactly. Yep. I actually, on that note, I had a conversation recently with a mother who contacted me, and she really wanted to be. Well, what happened was she actually found out that her daughter was dating another girl via reading, sort of by accident, reading an email that her daughter had sent to another girl. And this mom really wanted to be supportive, but really didn't know how to address it. One of her first thoughts was that she was concerned that her daughter had not come to her with this information and hadn't told her. You know, thoughts crossed her mind like, does my daughter somehow not trust me? Does my daughter, you know, this mother feeling guilty? Like, why did my daughter not feel like she could tell me that information? Or was my daughter lying to me or trying to intentionally hide this information? So I think with that, you know, parents sometimes do blame themselves of why is my child not told me this when I really just want to support them and love them unconditionally. It's important to remember, though, that stigma, sort of heteronormative stigma or stigma against being a gay or lesbian person or gender stigma towards transgender, gender nonconforming individuals occurs outside of the home, whether that's school, in society at large, through media, possibly a faith community. So even when parents are really intending to be accepting or supportive, just their child can get messages outside of the home that maybe their parents aren't going to support them, or maybe this is something to be stigmatized or ashamed of, even if the parents have never sent that message. So, you know, one of the things I really talked with this mom was not to blame herself for that, that wasn't her fault. It didn't mean that she was a bad mom, but that this can be a very scary thing for kids to talk about, even when their parents might be supportive.
To that note, heterosexual me, mm-hmm. I never told my parents when I was dating anybody because it was embarrassing to me. I was like, I don't want them to know that I like a boy, that I'm growing. This is a conversation I don't want to have. Uh-huh. So it might not have anything to do with the fact that the daughter felt uncomfortable about which position she was coming from, but maybe just didn't want to share that intimate part of her life at that point. So feel better, mom.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't, because totally. I never would have, I would have been like, huh.
And sometimes parents ask me, well, in that situation, a parent might say, well, should my child be grounded or get in trouble for not telling me this? Absolutely not. And to your point, it's developmentally appropriate that there are certain things that they just might not volunteer to tell you.
Placing their own boundaries.
Exactly. Yes. And, you know, the older a child gets, the more we want to allow them to start taking some more, becoming more independent, taking more responsibility. So I think that's just totally normal. And I think that's really one of my central messages is just to parents is to make this as normal as possible to keep that line of communication open. So for example, if a son comes to his father and says, "Dad, I'm dating another guy," the response should be, "What's his name? How'd you meet him?" Not, well, are you gay? Is this, how do you know you're attracted to guys? Again, questions like that send this message of stigma and you're doing something different rather than I'm going to treat you the same whether you're dating a boy or a girl.
All right. So we just need to remove that portion of it and ask the same questions we would kind of journalistically.
Absolutely.
All right. So part of in your bio, your research interests focus on the intersection of religion, spirituality, sexual orientation. It goes on and on because that's who you are.
Sure.
But let's talk about religion, because this is a huge portion of people who, because of how they were raised, because of their beliefs, don't feel like they can be supportive or express support and say this is okay. Yeah. They've been raised to think that it's not.
Yep.
How do we navigate those waters?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is something just as a real quick, you know, I was baptized as Roman Catholic, grew up primarily as an evangelical Christian. So religion's been a major part of my life and my value system, and is something that is really important to me. So I think everything I said for parents who are accepting of their kids being a gender or sexual minority also applies to parents who struggle with that news due to their religious beliefs. But there's also the hurdle of acceptance. So in those situations, I really try to appeal to the overarching tenets of that individual's faith system. So many religions are based on principles of acceptance, unconditional love, grace, compassion, non-judgment toward others. These core tenets can form the basis of a parent's response. In other words, a parent may not agree with a child's choices about who they date, or possibly how they express their gender identity, but they can affirm their love for their child, and that love is unconditional, and nothing will change that. They also can show support in the form of being non-judgmental, also something consistent with their religious beliefs, in that parents try and put themselves in their child's shoes, and know that their child didn't choose to be gay, their child didn't choose to be transgender. And again, just having that empathy, I think, is so consistent with, you know, for example, with Christianity, Jesus talking a lot about not judging others and just loving them. But not all parents' reservations are based in religion. Sometimes it just kind of comes as a shock because they already had sort of a vision in mind about the future of their child, their children's life. So, for example, a parent may have always envisioned their daughter marrying a man and wasn't prepared for their daughter to be dating or marrying a female-identified partner. And there's that sense of loss that still has to be worked through, no matter the parent's religious beliefs or their own background. And others might be supportive. Other parents may also be supportive, but also have fears of bullying. But that may lead them to ask their kids to conform to more typical heteronormative or traditional gendered behaviors and appearances, which a child can easily misinterpret as their parent disapproving or not supporting them. But really, it's that parent's love and just fear for their child that is driving that reaction. And I think a really important conversation for a parent to have is, you know, I do support you. I do accept you. But I worry for you. And this is why I'm responding that way. And a kid really needs to hear that, to make that distinction between, you know, my mom worries about me versus my mom doesn't support me. A big difference there, and not always clear if that conversation has not been had.
What if the parents know and the child hasn't? The child isn't necessarily even aware.
Yeah. So, you know, I usually try and encourage parents to not ask the child directly. So, for example, sitting them down and saying, you know, are you gay? Are you straight? You know, that puts a lot of pressure on a child, to have to share something they may not be ready to share yet. B, it also creates pressure for a child to choose an identity that they may not be ready to label themselves as. A parent saying, are you gay? Well, a lot of adolescents can have attractions toward members of the same gender. That doesn't make them gay. It may not even make them bisexual. You know, it may just be something normal, but they may consider themselves heterosexual. So, you know, I think that puts a lot of pressure on a child to have to answer the question and have to choose a label or an identity. Right then, exactly. Yep.
Okay.
And that's that's just, they're still figuring that out. They may not have that figured out till late teens, 20s, and it's okay to let them have that process. I do think, though, parents can send subtle messages, though, that if the child wants to have that conversation, they will be supportive. So, for example, on the news comes on and a same-gender couple or something about the Supreme Court ruling and the parent saying, isn't that great? I'm really glad that couple is happy and has the ability. Now they can show their love for one another. Again, that doesn't put any pressure on that child, but sends a really clear message.
That it's a safe space.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
There's so much more that we could talk about.
Sure.
But we have to get to our third segment. Josh, thank you so very much for this. I do invite all the listeners to hit subscribe so that you don't miss a moment of our podcast. This is On Social Health and Change, presented by Adler University. I am Hannah Stanley, and in our next segment, we are going to talk about non-monogamy. It's going to be fascinating. Stay tuned. Welcome back to part three of the sex episode. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Joining us now is Steve Dubois, professor of psychology at Adler, to talk with us about non-monogamous relationships. And before we jump into that conversation, I want to remind everyone to please hit subscribe as you're listening so that you don't miss a moment of any of the content we bring to you each and every week. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is. It's a pleasure to have you and your expertise. So before we get into all of the depth of this conversation, let's start with a definition of monogamy.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Let's start with the definition of non-monogamy.
Sure. We all know that other one. non-monogamy is something that people in a relationship, typically that relationship includes two people, but of course it can include more, when they openly agree on this new arrangement. So the new arrangement is basically when people come together, when people decide that either together or separately, they'll engage in sex with people outside their primary relationship. So it's not a PC term for cheating. Instead, it's a way for individuals in some couples to grow both individually and together while exploring outside the relationship under a set of rules that they decide on.
Okay, so this is maybe a newfangled term for an open relationship.
Yeah, and in fact, in the research now it's called consensual non-monogamy, or CNM, and so that implies that there is a deal made by the people in the relationship and terms are agreed to.
It seems so official to have it be less official. All right. So
takes the fun out of it a little.
Well, yeah, it might, I guess, maybe. But I'm thinking people who are involved with these kind of relationships probably don't call it that. So let's. I'd like to talk to you about having a non-monogamous relationship.
Sure.
I think that they use probably less official terms. When people are deciding to have this conversation, what are the reasons behind it?
Good question. So, you know, according to the top thinkers in the field, there's there's sort of a new emerging research finding that in order to make love last, there has to be both a mix of comfort in the relationship and risk-taking in the relationship. So intimacy has this sort of counterintuitive effect on desire. The closer we get to someone, the more aligned we become with that person and how we think and what we value. And also physiologically, the less our bodies respond to one another, the longer we've been together, the more we know each other. And so for long-term couples, and certainly for some short-term couples as well, there can be difficulty here as they become more aligned and some of that spark is lost. So some people interpret that lack of physiological arousal, that lack of exciting thoughts or emotions as a lack of desire for the partner. So in that case, non-monogamy or consensual non-monogamy or being in an open relationship provides the opportunity to take a risk together, thereby potentially cultivating the two people in the relationship's closeness and even their connectedness while exploring outside the relationship.
Okay, so the research is suggesting that having a non-monogamous relationship can make you more connected with the person you were in the monogamous relationship with.
Yeah, it's amazing. So increasingly, there's research done on this, and the findings are certainly mixed, so it's not like every study on this topic finds the same things all the time. But certainly, past studies on both gay male couples who participate in this arrangement, lesbian couples, and also heterosexual couples show that there are either no differences in things like depression, individual depression, anxiety, or that they're better off. Those things are better off for people in non-monogamous relationships. Also things like sexual intimacy, trust, those things are reported sometimes more highly in the consensual non-monogamous relationships than the monogamous ones.
Which is just throws everything that people have talked about out the window for so long. So how do couples come to have this conversation and decide that this is right for them?
Sure. Well, some relationships will begin on non-monogamous terms, or you might hear colloquially, like, we're in an open relationship, mm-hmm. and those relationships.
We hear it about celebrities all the time.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. and some will start that way. And typically that's because either one person or both in the relationship express a desire from the start. Then there's another group of couples. Those are those who decide to be monogamous to start, or maybe they don't even decide, it's just implicit. But then they make a decision more actively that they'd like to try non-monogamy. And that comes up usually one of two ways. The first is that one person has an active desire for something we would call extra dyadic or outside the dyad, outside the two people in the relationship. But that person wants to be open with, that is, they want to be upfront. They want to articulate that desire to their partner. They want to be honest with their partner about it. And that type of honesty and verbal openness predicts a more positive experience than, say, if the person engaged in infidelity. The other way that non-monogamy comes up is when couples see it as a proactive approach to making their sex lives more exciting. Having an openness to experience sex with other people before things start to feel like they're dwindling might be more of a preventative mindset to avoid that sense of feeling stuck or stagnant in the relationship.
All right. So this isn't necessarily having someone else join them in their sexual activity. This is actually going outside and finding different partners for themselves.
Great question. So this is where we get into the nuances of things. I mean, you can imagine the many, many iterations of non-monogamy or openness. And so it comes in many forms. Sometimes it is the first thing that you said, where maybe, and I think it was the first thing, maybe couples go out together and they kind of, we would say they play with other partners together.
Okay.
And another form of this.
Threesome.
Threesomes, foursomes, fivesomes.
Et cetera.
Right.
Yeah.
And then another iteration of this involves, again, agreed upon rules where each individual in the relationship can go seek their own sexual experience, not within the context of the relationship itself with the partner physically present. And in fact, yet another name that's been used to describe those types of relationships, some of those relationships, is something coined by Dan Savage years ago and then used in the research called monogamish relationships, which is, you know, sort of monogamous. And those are typically reserved for people who seek sex with someone else outside the relationship together.
Okay. All right. So how do these work? And obviously we can't cover all of this because, as you've said, there's as many different variations of this as there are people who probably who are involved with this. But just sort of on average-ish, sure. if you would, give sure. me the overview.
And we do have averages, right? There's been okay. enough research done that we can say typically it looks something like this. There have been some key components of non-monogamy that have kind of arisen from the literature and from clinical work with these individuals. And so those key components, I would say there are three, although certainly there are more if you keep looking for them. One is communication. I mean, it's the cornerstone of all relationships, but particularly when you are in a non-monogamous relationship, there's almost a painstaking amount of communication that's required, at least if you want to do it, I think, effectively. Communicating pre any sort of non-monogamous sexual experience, communicating during that to make sure you're staying connected, communicating after, kind of debriefing what happened, what did we learn, what do we want to change. So there's a lot of communication, which actually leads to some of the potential connectedness and closeness that is reported. Mm-hmm. Some couples start to communicate more than they ever have about sex when they start to kind of open up this option. A second key component, I would say, is flexibility. So flexibility in terms of what kind of non-monogamous relationship individuals are going to have. Who are they going to include? When? Where? All of the questions. So it's good to set those terms, but also be flexible to change. For example, you can imagine setting some terms and one or both partners not really jiving with those terms after they experiment with them. And so having an openness to be flexible, to set new terms, I think is really important as
well.
All
right. So we thought we came to an agreement and we are all, and then one of the people says, yeah, I'm not down with this caveat.
Indeed.
And then so you just kind of regroup and rehash. Okay.
Exactly. Which then presents an opportunity for problem solving together, which is another key kind of relationship facet that we know in the literature and clinical work really helps to build and maintain relationships. Related to that is, I would say, the third kind of key component of non-monogamy working, which is a prioritization of the partnership over the individual's needs. This can be tricky because sometimes, of course, one person is the one driving the desire to be non-monogamous. But I think it's really important for couples to discuss it openly and frequently before engaging in it so that it can be reframed as something that's good not just for the individual but for the relationship. And I think that's true that often, you know, or almost always what's good for the individual in a relationship is good for the relationship because an individual brings the best to the relationship. But I think those connections need to be made between the people in relationships. They need to be articulated, explored. And so I think that having those discussions helps to maintain that the relationship is going to take priority over, for example, an individual's sexual whims.
All right. I actually caught my reflection at one point during this conversation, and I can tell you that I was so amused by how perplexed I was by this avenue of thinking that that I really have to ask, is this common or is this something that people have been doing and we just haven't talked about? Because for me, I'm like, who does this? Mm-hmm. I've never thought about this before. But that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation, so that it can be out there. If this is something that 20% of the population is involved in, then this is something that we should be talking about far more frequently.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple things are happening simultaneously. It's becoming more common as a practice in relationships, and it's also becoming less stigmatized. So back in 2013, President Obama was on Good Morning America and gave support for gay marriage, but he actually qualified it by stating that he's supportive of monogamous relationships. And so even then, there was a little stigma associated with gay marriage, like only if it's under these terms.
As long as it's always what we've always accepted.
Exactly. The convention, right? And so we see, and of course, not to knock President Obama, but just to say, when looking at that a little closely, we actually picked up on some stigma there that was disseminated. 2-3 years later, I think there's less stigma, at least in the research, there's less stigma, and there's a higher prevalence than there used to be. It's one of those tough things. It's tough to get prevalence rates for, because who knows if more out there, we're just not capturing them, or people aren't telling us. But it's certainly more common, as stated earlier, in gay male relationships and lesbian relationships. In studies of gay males, the highest reported prevalence has been upwards of 60% of gay male couples participate in this type of arrangement. Much, much smaller proportions of heterosexual couples. For example, the going prevalence is about 5% of heterosexual couples classify themselves as open or in swinger type relationships.
That term is so funny. Okay. Well, I honestly, thank you so much for sharing this information with me and everyone, because this has given me a ton, so much to think about. Thank you, Steve. And this is going to conclude our show. Please join us next week for our episode, Fighting Addiction. Again, I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is on Social Health and Change presented by Adler University. Make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast on iTunes or on your Android app store, wherever you are able to download those from. We appreciate it. And again, next week, we will be talking about fighting addiction. That will be a can't miss. We'll talk to you next week.